western areas, but again, when you get the sunshine, the East Midlands, East Anglia and the southeast of England, 18 or 19 degrees is again possible.
Many thanks, Darren. Now, our new book of the week, She Left Me the Gun, Emma Brock's story of her mother Paula's past life in South Africa, where she lived before emigrating to England. In an unyielding account, Brock's investigates her mother's lost past and unearths a shocking family secret.
My mother first tried to tell me about her life when I was about 10 years old. I was sitting at the table doing homework or a drawing. She was standing at the grill cooking sausages. Every now and then the fat from the meat would catch and a flame leap out. She'd been threatening some kind of revelation for years. "One day I will tell you the story of my life," she said, "and you will be amazed." I had looked at her in amazement. The story of her life was, she was born, she had me, 10 years passed, end of story. "Tell me now," I'd said. "I'll tell you when you're older." A second later, I'd considered saying, "Am I old enough now?" But the joke hadn't seemed worth it. Anything constituting a life story would deviate from the norm in ways that could only embarrass me. I knew, of course, she'd come from South Africa and left behind a large family. 7 half-siblings, 8, including a boy who'd died. 10, if you counted the rumour of twins. "You should have been a twin," said my mother, whenever I did something brilliant, like open my mouth or walk across a room. "I hoped you'd be twins, with auburn hair. You could have been. Twins run in the family on both sides. And my stepmother was pregnant with twins once." There were no twins among her siblings. She always referred to her like this, as my stepmother. And unlike her siblings, for whom she provided short but vivid character sketches, and even her father, who featured in the odd story, her stepmother, Marjorie, was a blank. As for her real mother's family, all she would say was, "Strong women, strong genes," and give me one of her looks, a cross between "nobody knows the trouble I've seen" and "abandon all hope, ye who enter here," that shut down the possibility of further discussion. It wasn't evident from her accent that she came from elsewhere. She was imperiously English to her friends and erstwhile family in South Africa, but to me, at home, she was caustic about the English. The worst insult she could muster was to say, "You're so English." I was English. I was more than English. I was from the home counties. I played tennis in white clothing. I went to brownies. I didn't ride a horse. My mother thought horses an unnecessary complication. But I did everything else commensurate in those parts with being a nice girl. This was important to my mother, although she couldn't help now and then hinting at how tame it all was. "Call that sun," she said, when the English sun came out. "Call that rain." When I got bitten by a red ant at sports day, my mother inspected the dot while I started to sniffle. "For goodness sake, all that fuss over such a tiny little thing. Any ant worth its salt where she came from would kill you." My parents met at work in the 1960s, at the law firm where my dad was doing his articles and my mum was a bookkeeper. In the late 1970s, when I was a few years old, we moved out of the city to a village an hour away. It was a gentle kind of place. Leafy and green, with a closely mown cricket pitch, lots of pubs and antique shops, a war memorial on the high street, and, in the far distance, a line of wooded hills that on autumn days caught the sun and made the village postcard pretty. My mother was, in many ways, a typical resident. She went to yoga in the village hall. She stood in line at the post office. She made friends with the lady on the deli counter in Budgeons and had a nice relationship with a lovely family who lived next door to us. Their young boys would come round to look at the fish in our pond. When my parents bought the house, the garden had been a denuded quarter acre which my mother set about Africanising. She planted pampas grass and mint. She let the grass grow wild around the swing by the shed. Along the back fence, she put in fast-growing dogwoods. "It's to hide your ugly house," she said sweetly when our other neighbour complained. After that, Whenever my mother was out weeding and found a snail, she would lob it, grenade-like, over the fence into the old lady's salad patch.
"That's very aggressive," said my father, who is English and a lawyer.
"Ha!" said my mother, and gave him the look. "If you think that's aggressive, then you really haven't lived." Being an only child is a bit like being Spanish. You have your dinner late, you go to bed late, and your parents talk to you as if you were an adult, and when they're not talking to you, you have no one to talk to. So, you listen. I knew a few details from her childhood. There wasn't a total news blackout. My mother loved to tell stories, and there were a few dazzling set pieces I begged her to tell me again and again. She'd grown up in a series of small towns and remote villages, out in the Bundu, of what was then Zululand, now KwaZulu-Natal, so that most of her stories involved near-deadly encounters with the wildlife and weather. There were hailstones the size of golf balls. There was lightning to strike you dead as you were crossing a field. Those snakes that weren't hanging from trees waiting to drop down her back were fighting scorpions for the deeds to the toe end of her slippers. She told me about her Auntie Johanna cracking eggs into a bowl one day and releasing with the final egg a mass of tiny black snakes into the yellow mixture. A cobra had laid its eggs in the hen house. She told me about her brother Mike and the practical jokes he had played on her. From the earliest age, I knew what a bad idea it was to leave a dead snake in someone's bed as a joke, because its partner might come looking for it. Some snakes, she said, mate for life. As a consequence, if I ever went to Africa, I said, it would be on condition I could wear a balaclava, dungarees, Wellington boots and some kind of headgear. I pictured myself walking down a jungle path dressed in something halfway between a beekeeper's outfit and what you might wear to weld metal. We didn't go. Instead, every year or so, my dad and I watched as my mother raised the possibility and then talked herself out of it. Anyway, she said, if we went anywhere long haul, she would rather go to Australia. We didn't go to Australia. I got the impression we didn't go to Australia because at some level of my mother's thinking, going to Australia meant flying over Africa. It is quite an achievement in a village in England to feel that evasive action is being taken to avoid the Southern Hemisphere. But that's how it was. Letters came in from her siblings occasionally, nothing for years, and then a 15-page blockbuster written entirely in capitals. She would leave it on the kitchen table for me for when I got home from school. "Read it to me," she said, and I would. These letters were like dispatches from Mars, particularly those from her sister Doreen, 13 years her junior, and, said my mother, an out-and-out troublemaker. "He loves me," he says. "He will post my ring to me," he says. "There is no other," he says. "Paula, am I a bloody old fool?" To me, her siblings had a kind of mythical status, partly from the glamour all large families hold for only children, and partly from their complete and utter absence from our lives. When my mother talked about them, it was as of a people she had known a long time ago and had been very fond of once. There was one, her conscience. There were two, she hardly knew. There was one who died of whooping cough as a child, whose small white coffin she remembered walking behind. There were two she called her babies. Faye was my baby. Steve was my baby. Who she'd brought up, more or less, when her stepmother's hands were full. There were no photos of these people around the house, but she did once dig out a cardboard box from the garage to show me some old sepia-coloured photos from an even earlier era. This, she said, was before her mother had died and her father remarried and had so many more children. One was of my mother as a baby, standing in a hot-looking crib clutching hold of the bars. In another, she was standing waving in a garden. On the back, my grandmother Sarah had written Pauline on her second birthday. There were two further photos in the set, my mother as a toddler with fat little legs and scrunched down socks, standing beside a fresh grave, the soil still exposed, and in the same position on a different day, the grave already looked older. Someone had written on the back, Pauline arranging flowers on her mother's grave. But who that was, She had no idea. Shame, said my mother, when she showed me the photos. Poor little thing. As if it was not her we were looking at, but someone entirely unrelated to either of us. I remember asking her once if we had any heirlooms. We didn't, she said, because she could only fit so much in her trunk, and besides, her mother had died when she was two. What did I want? I was goading her a little, I knew it. In fact, there was something my mother wanted me to have. It had come over on the boat with her in an old-fashioned trunk, the kind with its ribs on the outside. Before I moved countries myself and understood the pull of sentiment over practicality, I thought her packing choices eccentric. So, no overcoat, although she was sailing into an English winter, but a six-piece dinner service. The complete works of Jane Austen minus Mansfield Park. A tapestry she had done, even though she wasn't arty, of a 17th century English drawing room scene in which someone played the harpsichord and someone else the lute. And at the bottom of her trunk, wrapped in a pair of knickers, her handgun. Getting it through customs undetected was her first triumph in the new country. The gun was kept in a secret drawer beneath the bookcase in the downstairs guest bedroom. The drawer was where she kept her most precious items, her naturalisation papers, a list of how much I weighed during the first 6 months of my life, various documents testifying to her abilities as a bookkeeper, and the gun. Remember, it's here, she said, the one time she showed it to me. And remember my jewels. Don't let your father's second wife get her hands on them. Ha! Called my dad from the hallway. I should be so lucky. My mother smiled. You'll miss me when I'm gone. It was smaller than I'd imagined. Silver, with a pearl handle, like something a highwayman might proffer through a frilly sleeve during a slightly fey hold-up. I knew it was illegal, but gun licensing wasn't the issue then it is now, and it struck me as naughty in the order of, say, a white lie. She had it, she said, because everybody had one. I think she saw it as a jaunty take on the whole stuffy English notion of inheritance, just the thing for a woman to bequeath to her only daughter. My dad hated having it in the house and threatened once to throw it in the local arm of the Grand Union Canal. You'll do no such thing, my mother raged. I'm very fond of that gun. Of everything she brought over with her, it was the one item she most wanted me to have. This will be yours one day, she said, long before those kind of conversations were necessary. In the end, however, the price of a gesture can be too high to bear. In 1990, a gun amnesty was declared in Britain, and my mother decided that, after all, it might get me into trouble. Reluctantly, she laid it in a box, like a dead pet, and drove it to the police station. By the time she got back, she cheered up. The female desk sergeant had squealed when she opened the box and called out her fellow officers from the back room. It was the only contribution to the amnesty they'd had. They were completely intrigued, said my mother, beaming. I suppose I don't look the type.
She Left Me the Gun by Emma Brox was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by Alison Pettit. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Rather a lot of shipping information for you shortly, and to get us there, a sustaining sliver of Sailing By. Just a hint of its glory, but still with us anyway. Now to the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Tuesday the 16th of April. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Plymouth, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides and Fair Isle. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, Shannon, 975, expected Hebrides, 983, by 1800 Tuesday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, southerly, veering southwesterly later, 4 or 5, increasing 6 to gale 8, perhaps severe gale 9 later. Rain, good, occasionally poor. Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, south or southwest, 5 to 7, increasing gale 8 or severe gale 9 for a time. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, White, Portland. South or southwest, 4 or 5, increasing 6 or 7 for a time. Occasional rain, fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. Plymouth, northwest Biscay, southerly or southwesterly, 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 at first in Plymouth. Rain, fog patches later, moderate, occasionally very poor later. Southeast Biscay, variable 4, fair, moderate or poor. Southeast Trafalgar, northerly or northeasterly, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in the east. Fair, moderate or good. Northwest Trafalgar, southeast Fitzroy, southwesterly, 5 or 6, fair, good, occasionally poor. Northwest Fitzroy, Sole, southerly or southwesterly, 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 at first in Sole, decreasing 4 for a time.